clock to see if our time is up yet. I was reminded, Evan, when you were speaking just now, about what happened with your father. Now I'm the one shifting in my chair. When you first found out that his wife was pregnant, that your father was going to have another son, it seemed to trouble you a great deal. You seemed to think it reflected on your father's feelings towards you. Dr. Sherman consults his notes. That was about a month ago when we discussed that, he says. You haven't mentioned it since, so I'm just wondering, how have you been coping with that? I'm in bed watching a movie I've already seen. The bottom of my computer warms my thighs, definitely giving me cancer. My eyes are trained on the screen, but I'm barely watching. I'm too busy ruminating on what Dr. Sherman brought up at our session. It's something I try not to think about or talk about, which is exactly the type of thing Dr. Sherman loves to harp on. Fine, Teresa's pregnant. My dad is going to have a new son. What's the point of even bringing it up? What does Dr. Sherman want me to say about it? He won't be born for many more months, and when he gets here, he'll be in Colorado. He won't know me, and I won't know him. When I was young, I begged my parents for a sibling. I'd dream about having a brother or sister. But now? No thanks. The mattress sags beneath me. My mom is suddenly by my side, propping a pillow behind her back. I didn't hear her come home. She focuses on the computer screen as if it's broadcasting the secret of life. She was not happy when she found out about the baby. She tried to pretend like she didn't care, but then I heard her on the phone with a friend saying, I could have a baby right now if I wanted to. Right now. And later, isn't he a little old to be having a new baby? What are you watching? She asks now. It's the documentary about Vivian Meyer, the nanny who no one realized was also a brilliant photographer until after she died. And who's the kid talking? She asks. That's the guy who discovered all her photos after she died. He's the one who made the film about her. He paid for it with Kickstarter. This guy's impressive. Not he. She. Vivian Meyer is a woman. I know that. Jeez, give me some credit. I'm talking about the guy who put the whole thing together. Oh. Right. The filmmaker. His name is John Maloof, and the movie is also about him. I guess my mom's right. He is impressive. Without him, no one would know about Vivian Meyer. I take a closer look at the guy on screen. He's not a star or anything. Far from it. He's dorky, actually, with glasses and bad skin. He looks really young, too. He just cared enough to do something. He made it his mission to make sure that the world appreciated Vivian Meyer. Vivian Meyer was a nobody, but John changed that. He wouldn't let her be ignored or forgotten. He made people pay attention. He saved her. I lift my arm out from under the blanket and read once again the name written on my cast. Chapter 14. My mom enters the kitchen and freezes in her clogs. You're up early, she says. I press one more key on my laptop and slam it shut. The printer croaks awake in the living room. I stand up from the table. I had to finish something. My mom inserts a pod into the coffee maker. It wouldn't happen to be one of those scholarship essays, would it? Not yet. But I've been, like, brainstorming a ton of ideas and stuff. I totally forgot about the essays. That sounds so exciting, she says, sliding our only clean mug under the spout. And you're sure you don't want to plan another night to do them together? I told you, this time I'll just tell my boss I don't even exist. I am non-existent on that day, except to you. I promise. She's already apologized 50 times about blowing taco night, and I appreciate the effort, but right now those essays are the last thing on my mind. Maybe. I'll definitely let you know. Wait, where are you going? I can't delay. I need to retrieve the papers coming out of the printer. The last time I printed out something private, it fell into the wrong hands. Is everything okay? She asks. I turn around in the doorway. Yeah, it's just this thing for school. No, I mean in general. Your session with Dr. Sherman went well? And before you answer, I want you to know that I was going to ask you about it last night, but I didn't because I know you need time to process. How's that for Mother of the Year material? She laughs awkwardly. You're a shoo-in, I say, scratching loose paint off the wall. Actually, I think I might have had a little breakthrough with Dr. Sherman. You would think I just handed her a winning lottery ticket. She shoots up two thumbs and dances her fists in the air.
That's what I'm talking about.
Another happy customer. I catch Alana as she's heading into homeroom. On the way to school, I folded each piece of printed paper twice to form three equal sections. They're supposed to resemble pamphlets. Alana takes one of my pamphlets and reads the front panel.
The Connor Project? Alana says.
It's the first thing that came to me, I say. It doesn't have to...
I love it. What is it?
Well, it would be a student group dedicated to keeping Connor's memory alive and showing that he mattered. That everyone matters. Alana is silent. I repeat to myself what I just said aloud. It sounds preposterous now that I'm hearing it back. There are at least a dozen more of these prototype pamphlets in my bag. I wonder if the school has a paper shredder I can borrow. It's just a rough idea. It doesn't have to be that, obviously.
I'm so honored, Alana says. I would love to be vice president of the Connor Project.
Vice president?
You're right. We should be co-presidents.
I guess that means she's into my idea.
So you think we should actually do this? Are you kidding, Evan? We have to. Like you said, not just for Connor. For everyone.
She holds up my pamphlet next to her face.
Excuse my language, but screw Miss Bortle.
No plan I've made for the future has ever actually panned out. I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do next. I was thinking we'll probably need a good website. I know someone who could help with that, but it might cost us.
Tech conciliary, Jared says when Alana and I approach him during lunch.
What's that? Alana asks. It's a godfather thing, right? I say.
Precisely, Jared says. I will forego my normal fee in exchange for being referred to as a tech conciliary of the Connor Project.
Fine, whatever, I say. You can list it that way on the website.
No, you need to call me that in normal conversation, too.
Jared, come on.
How about we give you the additional role of treasurer, Alana offers. It'll look great on your college applications.
Jared studies Alana's face. Alana holds his stare.
That would please my parents, Jared says.
I'm sure it would, Alana says.
Fine. Can I eat my lunch now?
Wait, Alana says. Shouldn't we get the Murphy's blessing before we move forward? I thought about that too. I just figured it might be a little early for that since we're only in the setup phase.
There's really no point in putting a lot of work into this until we know we have the Murphys on board, Alana argues. We should pitch it to them immediately, like tonight.
You mean all of us together, I ask?
Jared nods. Yeah, let's go to their house.
I guess we could, I say, overwhelmed but excited.
A team outing.
Alana goes to squeeze my arm, I think, but then seeing the cast, thinks better of it.
I love it. Great for morale. I'll drive, Jared says. Just text me a pickup time.
One more thing, Alana says before Jared can leave.
How about we organize a school-wide assembly to kick this thing off?
I knew Alana would be the right partner, that she'd be able to take the ball and really run with it. Yeah, that sounds great.
Perfect. I'll speak to Principal Howard about it. See you guys tonight.
She walks away, and so does Jared. Last night, it was just a vague, unsure concept in my mind. Now it's this real thing that feels like it might actually happen. It's sort of thrilling to watch it come alive so fast, and yet I'm suddenly looking around for a place to sit. My legs have gone numb. Despite my insistence that he park on the street, Jared dumps his SUV smack in the middle of the Murphy's C-shaped driveway. On our way to the front door, Alana flips open a folder and shows off two thick rubber-banded bundles of multicolored pamphlets. My Connor Project heading has been restyled, the small and modest font I used replaced with something thick and bold.
I had a window in my after-school schedule, Alana says when she catches me looking at the pamphlets.
Shouldn't we wait to hear what they say first, I say.
We have to go in there like the position is already ours.
But this isn't like an interview. Alana pulls at the cuffs of her shirt so they reach down to her wrists.
Life is an interview, Evan.
Where do you learn something like that? Alana's parents must be super successful people. I bet one is a judge and the other is a surgeon. From the moment she was born, she's been training to kick life's ass.
Is the maid gonna answer the door or what? Jared says, sounding the doorbell. They don't have a maid, I say.
Look at the size of this pillar. I bet you the Murphys are swingers.
What? No, they're just normal. Jared pretends to laugh. I notice he's wearing one of the Connor buttons he's been selling at school. Before I can tell him to take it off, the front door opens. It's Connor's mom.
Evan, what a surprise.
Hi, Mrs. Cynthia. I have something really exciting I want to share with you, I say.
Oh, she says, smiling at Alana and Jared.
She spots the image pinned to Jared's shirt. I can't read her expression before she invites us inside. She plants us around the dinner table with miniature bottles of water and excuses herself. Alana hides the folder with all the new pamphlets on her lap under the table. Meanwhile, Jared is threatening to steal a splash of something fun from the cabinet in the corner. He also assures us that the slot in the living room ceiling houses a retractable screen for a movie projector. I wait in my seat, wiping my wet hands on my jeans. I'm nervous, but also full of anticipation. Cynthia returns to the kitchen with Larry. I wasn't sure Larry would even be home from work yet, but the way he's dressed, in a polo shirt and cap, who knows, he might have skipped work and played golf instead. Zoe arrives just behind her father and takes a seat at the table directly next to me. She doesn't greet me with words, just a look. And as usual, I'm unable to decipher what her look means. Once everyone is settled, I take a drink of water and begin the presentation that we only vaguely sketched out on the way over.
I've been thinking a lot lately. I keep asking myself, what if there was a way to make sure that Connor was never forgotten, that he was always remembered, and that the memory of him could help people?
I study our audience. I have their undivided attention.
Connor is gone, I say delicately.
But his legacy isn't. It doesn't have to be. I remember to breathe. There are so many things to cover.
Okay, I say. Imagine, first, a beautiful and informative website designed by Jared here, our tech consigliere.
Jared nods.
Yep, I can have that up pretty quickly.
This website would have links to educational materials and meaningful calls to action,
Alana says, barely able to contain herself.
Right, yes, and that's just the beginning, I start running through the list that we brainstormed. There would be steady outreach through social media, community events,
Alana takes over,
partnerships with strategic sponsors, a massive fundraising drive, suicide prevention resources, mental health education.
That way we can try to help people, just like Connor, I say.
Exactly, Alana says. And it's all part of this new initiative we've come here to present to you.
We're calling it the Connor Project, I say.
While I do value Alana's enthusiasm, this whole thing was my idea. Also, I didn't mean to say it so loudly.
The Connor Project, Cynthia says, turning to her husband.
Yes, I say. I glance at Alana, signaling that it's time. She opens her folder and hands everyone a pamphlet. I'm surprised when I get mine how substantial the paper feels.
We want to kick off the Connor Project in the right fashion, Alana says. I already spoke to Principal Howard about doing a memorial assembly this Friday. Students, teachers, whoever wants to, they can get up and they can talk.
About how all this has been affecting them, I say.
Right, how they're feeling.
About Connor.
Yes, what he meant to them.
What he meant to all of us.
It seems a good place to stop, and somehow we all sense it. I turn to Alana and Jared, feeling a sense of pride and accomplishment. The room is eerily still and mute until the ice maker produces a loud clink. It takes a few sips of water and more inspection of the pamphlets before Connor's parents are ready to speak.
I didn't realize Connor meant this much to people, Larry says.
Oh my God, Alana says. He was one of my closest acquaintances. He was my lab partner in chemistry, and we presented together on Huck Finn in English. He was so funny. Instead of calling it Huck Finn, he switched out the Huck, you know, and he called it...
She catches herself.
Nobody else in our class thought of that.
Zoe hasn't looked up from her pamphlet since she got it. If she's not on board with our plan, I'm not sure I can be either.
I was thinking, I say, for the assembly, maybe the jazz band could do something?
Zoe glances up.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
I can ask Mr. Cantrell.
Jared slaps me on the back. Great idea, Evan.
Thank you, Jared, I say through clenched teeth.
Honey, Larry says, touching Cynthia's shoulder, what do you think?
Usually Cynthia is the one who does most of the talking for the Murphys, but she's been awfully quiet. She's looking straight at me, but not at my eyes. It's like she can't see past the space between us.
And then she emerges from her waking sleep.
Oh, Evan, this is just... this is wonderful. Thank you.
She grabs my hand from across the table and squeezes it. It feels so nice that I almost forget to be embarrassed.
Once again, I'm in Connor's bedroom, only this time with his mother. Alana and Jared already left. We were all getting ready to leave together when Cynthia pulled me aside and asked if I could stay a little longer. I don't mind taking the bus home. Now she's looking in Connor's closet. Through the walls, I hear a voice singing over guitar. After a few stops and starts, I realize it's not a recording. Cynthia turns around. She's holding a tie. After studying the tie a moment, she extends it to me.
For the assembly.
Oh. When Connor started 7th grade, all my girlfriends said, "Here comes bar mitzvah season. He's going to have a different party every Saturday." I took him to get a suit. Some shirts.
A tie?
She pauses.
He didn't get invited to a single one.
We both look down at the tie in her hands. Connor's tie. His only tie. He never wore it. Never had a reason to.
I thought you could wear this for your speech, she says.
The taste of panic on my tongue.
My what?
Well, Alana said that anyone who wanted to would have a chance to say something at the assembly. I think we all assumed that you would be the first to sign up.
I don't...
Panic has a salty taste. It's like I'm standing in a small glass tank and the tank is filling up with water. I'm guessing the water is coming from the sea because of the saltiness. The seawater rushes into my tank. It's already at my mouth, and in a moment it will cover my face and I'll drown. There's no way out of the tank. All I can do is wait as the water surrounds me. I stretch my neck up for the last bit of air. I'm gasping, and then, when I can barely catch my breath, it stops.
The water recedes, always. I never end up drowning, but it doesn't matter. The feeling of almost drowning is even worse than actually drowning. Actually drowning is peace. Almost drowning is pure pain.
The thing is just, I don't really do very well with public speaking. I'm not very good at it. You wouldn't want me to, trust me.
Of course I would want you to, Cynthia says. I'm sure the whole school wants to hear from you. I know Larry and I do, and Zoe.
She puts the tie in my hands.
Think about it.
She leaves me alone in Connor's room. I stand there, paralyzed, waiting for all the water to drain away. I stare down at Connor's tie, thick and rough, navy with light blue diagonal stripes running down it, like rolling waves through a dark, violent ocean. The water came for Connor, too. He must have fought for air until he just didn't feel like fighting anymore. If I can understand anything, I can certainly understand that. A sound in the doorway. Zoe stands there with her arms crossed.
Sorry, I tell her. I'm leaving. Your mom and I were just talking.
She steps into the room and makes a slow circle around me before finally resting on the bed. The last time we were alone like this in Connor's room, I apparently lost my mind. I'll keep better track of it this time. Zoe didn't say much after our presentation. When it was over, she just disappeared upstairs. I wait for her to speak, and when she doesn't, I proceed with extreme care.
Was that you playing guitar just now?
She nods.
I didn't know you sing, I say.
I don't. I mean, I'm not very good. It's sort of a new thing. Actually, this past Sunday, I played my first open mic night at Capitol Cafe. Just a few songs.
Wow, no way. Like, covers, or...
My own stuff.
she says, looking a little hesitant but fighting through it. It's weird. It's like I've had these songs waiting inside me, and now they're finally ready to come out.
I understand. I'm jealous, actually. I wish I had some way of releasing all the stuff that's been churning inside me. I sit down on the bed as far away from her as I can possibly be without falling off.
That's awesome. She turns to me.
You shouldn't have kissed me the other night. That was annoying.
Damn. I sat myself right into that one.
I know. I'm sorry.
But, she says, I shouldn't have freaked out. I overreacted.
No, you underreacted. I don't even know why I did it.
She stares down at the floor, her shoes scrunched up as if they're trying to push right through the wood.
I think grief can make you do weird things. Things you wouldn't do normally.
I gave her the only answer I can.
I think that's probably true.
She stands up and paces around. I follow her movements until she stops and faces me head on.
Why did he push you that day?
What?
Oh. I mean, I think...
The seawater returns. I was just starting to dry off.
Didn't I tell you before?
She shakes her head.
I don't believe you.
My heart cracks. I look away, studying Connor's wall as if it were a cheat sheet, but what I see only confuses me more. I close my eyes and search inward instead.
I get scared talking to people, I guess, sort of.
The truth of it calms me down. I slowly open my eyes.
Connor was always trying to get me to be more outgoing. And he'd get annoyed sometimes. If he thought I wasn't trying hard enough. That sort of thing.
She takes it in.
Well, my mom is in love with you. This whole Connor project thing, too. She's obsessed.
I feel my heart gluing back together again.
She's really awesome.
Zoe glances at the open door, seeing something I can't see.
She likes you being here. You make her feel like Connor is still here, I think, in a way. Like you bring him with you somehow. But not like how she remembers him. Different.
Better than she remembers him.
That's what happens when people leave, I think. When they're gone, you don't have to be reminded of all the bad things. They can just stay the way you want them forever.
Perfect. I'm not sure if that made any sense. I watch Zoe, waiting for some kind of reaction. She stands there for a moment, saying nothing. Finally, she nods, turns, and goes.
4. A flyer stapled to a telephone pole. Connor Project Kickoff Ceremony. And so here I am. How could I miss it? An event in my honor. Students, teachers, local paper, even the folks are in attendance. There are speeches, a slide presentation, a performance by Zoe and the Jazz Kids. This is really something. I mean, I'm almost flattered, and yet call it habit, but I can't shake the feeling that they're only fucking with me. How can I not? They stand here talking about how much I meant to them, how much they relate, how they feel the things I felt. The isolation, unworthiness, loneliness. But how the hell do they know how I felt? I had to die for them to notice I was ever alive. I'm ready to leave, but a new speaker is being called to the stage. He's being referred to as Connor's best friend. I tremble. Could it really be him? Maybe my absence finally registered. I move closer, searching, but as soon as the speaker hits the stage, I see it's not a match. Just from the walk. Stiff and unsure. Nothing like him. Stupid to even dream it. Instead, it's my other bestie, Evan Hansen. What's the deal with this kid? And why the fuck is he wearing my tie? I'm positive it's mine. I picked it out myself years ago. My mother took me shopping for a suit. She said it would be good to have one for a special occasion. Always the dreamer, my mother. Rather than burst her bubble, I went along with it. I let her believe my special occasion was coming. Curiosity draws me closer to the stage. It's a totally different show up here, a little too intimate. I can see the beads of sweat on his forehead, hands fumbling on a stack of index cards. He won't even look at the crowd. Been a minute and he hasn't even said hello. Finally, he moves his lips. Voice so frail. Even with the microphone, you have to lean in to hear him. And I'm only a few feet away. It's hard to imagine anything more fragile. Honestly, it wouldn't shock me if he burst into flames under that light. With shaking uncertainty, he reads through two index cards. Good morning, students and faculty. I would just like to say a few words for you today about my best friend, Connor Murphy. I'd like to tell you about the day that we went to the old Autumn Smile apple orchard. Connor and I, we stood underneath an oak tree, and Connor said he wondered what the world would look like from all the way up there. So we decided to find out. We started climbing slowly, one branch at a time. When I finally looked back, we were already 30 feet off the ground. Connor just looked at me and smiled that way he always did, and then, well then I... He wipes his hand on his shirt. I fell. He keeps wiping. I lay there on the ground, and then... He turns to the next card. Good morning, students and faculty. I would... The entire stack drops to the floor. Cards everywhere. I turn to gauge the crowd. My fellow spectators have lost their patience. Scattered whispers build to a steady rumble. Phones alight. The drama on stage filmed, immortalized. Poor guy. Aware, but oblivious. Down on his knees, collecting his words. I can see the tears forming. I know that look. When your insides are about to pour right out of you and it's too late to stop it. You're naked. Everyone watching. They see you there, defenseless, and they pounce. No mercy.
Chapter 15. A silence over everything. Not sure when it arrived, if it's been here the whole time. I squint past the lights to see if I'm suddenly alone. But no, they're all still here. Hundreds of them. Staring. Waiting. For me to do something. To say something. To stop drowning. I'm on the ground. Knees vibrating against the stage. I can't stop shaking. My cards scattered, out of sequence. Everything out of sequence. I fight back the tears. Bringing my gaze in, I notice, running down my chest, the tie. I slide my fingers over it, feel its weight, soak up its power. I have to finish this. Legs wobbling, my whole body a convulsing mess. I rise to stand. It takes every ounce of power and adrenaline to make it to my feet. To lift. The cards remain on the stage. I don't need them. I've told the story so many times I could recite it in my sleep. I just have to open my mouth and speak. Slowly, I raise my chin and lean into the microphone. I fell, I say, my voice carrying off into the distance. I push out the words one by one. I lay there, on the ground. I shut my eyes. Any second now. But see, the thing is, when I looked up, Connor was there. He always is, somehow. Day after day he comes, the thought of him. Visions in the night, his name on my arm. No matter what I do, where I go, a constant reminder. Of what? Of who I am. Of who I could be. Who I should be. I open my eyes. That's the gift that he gave me. To show me that I wasn't alone. To show me that I matter. I do, don't I? And not just me. That everybody does.
That's the gift he gave all of us. I just wish...
It's the worst part. How unfair it is.
I wish we could have given that to him.
It grips me. Sinks in. A slow sobering. Then terror returns. Realizations. Where I am. What I'm doing. What I'm saying. What am I saying? I listen for the echo of my voice in the auditorium, trying to make out my own words, trying to catch up with myself, but my voice is long gone. There's only silence. Did I speak at all just now? Or did I only imagine it? I look up, blinded by the lights. What have I done? Leave. Now! Panic-stricken, I turn and I go, and I don't look back.
5. He steps away from the mic and hurries off the stage. A pause. Everywhere. What was that? Again, my default reaction, this has to be a joke. I'm being messed with. But my gut says otherwise. I mean, the story he told wasn't real. It never happened. But the spirit of what he was saying, how he was saying it, in some weird way it felt true. Like he actually meant it. There hasn't been much encouragement these last few years. Even when I'd get the occasional compliment, Connor, you're so artistic, funny, passionate, I never believed it. Against all the negative feedback, a few nice words didn't register. Also, it depends on who was giving the compliments. They meant less from my mother, who overdid it, more from my father, who underdid it, and the most from... That's the fucked up part about this speech. It would have really meant something coming from a true friend. He should have been the one standing up there saying those words. Because for him, I actually did show up. For him, I risked it all. Around me, there's a growing sound. And as usual, I only ended up hurting myself. First, sparse. What difference did any of it make? Then steady. Did I even matter at all? Hitting me, slowly. What I'm hearing, like an answer. Applause.
Chapter 16. Even with my pillow covering my face and pressed against my ears, I can still hear my phone vibrating against my nightstand. It's the third time it's done this dance this morning. I would have buried it in my sock drawer before bed if I thought anyone might be trying to get in touch with me today. But no one ever tries to get in touch with me. And anyway, if there was ever a morning where I didn't want the world to find me, this is the one. I suppose the universe has shown me some small mercy by making yesterday's assembly fall on a Friday, which means I don't have to show my face at school today. Disturbing images from the event flash in my memory. My index cards flying everywhere. Dropping down to my knees, the deafening silence. But one thing that I can't recall is what I actually said up there. I didn't even wait to see how the assembly ended. The thought of having to face people, especially the Murphys, sent me fleeing. In a blind panic, I walked right out of school and skipped my last few classes. I couldn't bear the idea of riding the bus home, being trapped with my classmates as they offered reviews of the travesty they had just witnessed on stage. I know it wasn't supposed to be a comedy, but I thought parts of it were hilarious. The name Evan Hansen shall hereby be used as a verb meaning to crash, to burn, to meet with disaster. No thank you. I walked home, and when I got here, I crawled right under the covers. I left my sneakers next to the bed, laces loosened, just in case I had to take off running in the middle of the night. For weeks now, I've been waiting for the worst to come, thinking it would be something unexpected and beyond my control, and in the end, I basically chased it. I walked right on stage, wearing Connor's tie directly into the worst thing that could happen. My phone is still vibrating. I remove the pillow from my face. It's Alana calling. If I weren't so busy hating myself, I'd be hating her instead. It was her idea to have that assembly. She should have never encouraged me in the first place when I told her about the Connor Project.
She should have been straight with me. Sorry, Evan, but you should drop this immediately. It's way beyond your skills as a human being. Where have you been? Alana says when I finally pick up. You haven't responded to any of my emails or texts. I give no response. Hello? Alana says. I drop an Ativan into my mouth and flush it down with two-day-old water. I'm here. My speech lasted 12 hours. That's how long it felt, standing on that stage, under those blazing lights. I couldn't make out their faces, but I knew they were out there. I've never almost drowned for such an extended period of time. I'm exhausted. I might never get out of bed again. Have you seen it? Alana says. Here we go. Why did I pick up the phone? Seen what? What's happening with your speech? Now it's too late. Now I need to know. What's happening with my speech? Someone put a video of it online, she says. My speech? I'm awake now. Every cell in my body is wide awake. It's officially over for me. Evan, it's totally insane. People started sharing it, and now it's everywhere. Connor is everywhere. What do you mean, everywhere? This morning, the Connor Project page had 56 people following it. That's not bad, actually. Last I checked, we were in the teens. How many does it... Now it has over 4,000. Did you say 4,000, Alana says. That's more people than we have in our entire school. I sit up and open my laptop. Alana's still talking, but I'm barely listening. I refresh my browser. She's not lying. Actually, we're almost at 6,000 now. What is going on? I see a message from Jared waiting for me. Dude, your speech is everywhere. I'll call you back, I tell Alana. My inbox is brimming with new emails. I find the first one that Alana sent and click the link to the video. I stop the video before it plays. I don't need to see my speech. Under the video, though, is a long string of comments, and I can't stop myself from looking. A few of the posts are from names I recognize, but most are from strangers. Some of the comments have links to other pages. I click on those links, and I wander over to other websites and to new conversations among more people who I definitely don't know. I'm bouncing through space, from star to star, drawing lines that form a picture. I'm starting to see the picture as a whole, but I don't understand what the picture means or how it came to be. It's not what I expected. Oh my God, everybody needs to see this. I can't stop watching this video. 17 years old. Take 5 minutes. This will make your day. Share it with the people you love. Repost. The world needs to hear this. A beautiful tribute. Favorite. I know someone who really needed to hear this today. Thank you, Evan Hansen, for doing what you're doing. Yes, yes, yes. I never met you, Connor, but coming on here, reading everyone's posts, it's so easy to feel alone, but Evan is exactly right. We're not alone. None of us. We're not alone. None of us is alone. Like, forward, share. Especially now, with everything you hear in the news, why can't there be more of this kind of thing? Share. Sending prayers for Michigan. Richmond, Vermont, Tampa, Sacramento, Kansas City. Forward. Thank you, Evan Hansen. Love. The best. I'm so in. Why do I have tears in my eyes? I feel like I've been found. Thank you, Evan. Watch until the end. Thank you, Evan Hansen. This video is everything right now. Thank you, Evan. All the feels. This is about community, the meaning of friendship. Thank you, Evan Hansen, for giving us a space to remember Connor, to be together, to find each other, to be found. Thank you. Thanks, Evan. Thank you, Evan Hansen. It's true. My speech is everywhere. And not just that. People like it. They really like it. A ringing startles me. It's the front door. The doorbell. My mother will get it. I return to my inbox. It's full of emails from actual people, not companies. Here's one from my English teacher, and somehow Sam from lunch got my email. The doorbell rings again. I crawl out of bed. I hear the shower running and my mom saying, Evan, I think someone's at the door.
I look out her bedroom window and see a car in the driveway. A blue Volvo. A quick glance in the mirror.
My hair is unacceptable, but I have no means to correct it.
The one time when I could use a little moisture on my hands, they're completely dry. Conveniently, though, I'm already fully dressed.
Why is Zoe here? She can't be here right now. My mom has no idea what's been going on with her and the Murphys. I didn't intend to keep it all a secret. It just happened that way. I'm already running down the stairs and opening the front door before I realize I should have at least taken a second to gargle some mouthwash.
The sun roars behind her.
Hi, I say.
Hey, she says. She looks as exhausted as I feel. Somehow it looks good on her.
I would invite you in, but my mom is really sick and I'm taking care of her. I'm sorry.
Why are you here?
She lowers her eyes.
That sounded rude, I say. I didn't mean it that way.
Great, I did it again. She won't even look at me. I Evan Hansen'd it.
She wipes her eye.
Wait, are you crying?
Zoe nods.
Why? Why are you crying?
She shakes her head. Because she can't speak. Or because she doesn't know why she's crying. Or because it doesn't even matter.
Everything you said in your speech. Everything you've done for all of us. Everyone. My family. Me.
No, I...
What am I trying to say? I don't even know. My brain has shut down. Do I want to apologize? Do I want to tell her the truth? Do I want the ground to swallow me?
She looks up. She takes a step. And then my lips and her lips, again. Only this time, it's not my doing.
She pulls back and exhales.
Thank you, Evan Hansen, she says. She turns and walks away, leaving me alone on the doorstep, exploding.
Part 2. Chapter 17.
Hey everybody, it's me, Alana, co-president, associate treasurer, media consultant, chief technology officer, and assistant creative director / public policy director for creative public policy initiatives for the Connor Project.
Hi, I'm Evan. I'm co-president of the Connor Project. I see my face on one side of the screen and Alana's on the other. I'm assuming it's the same visual Alana is seeing on her screen at home, and the same one our audience is seeing too, but this being our first ever live-streamed update, I'm not positive.
I wish I could see all of your amazing faces out there, Alana says.
I hope you're having an amazing day, I add.
It's crazy to think how many people are waiting right now to hear what we have to say. Our viewer count is currently in the high hundreds and climbing.
Wildly successful in my book, but Alana assures me that it's not really about the people watching live. It's about the traction we get after the fact.
Once we log off this morning, the video will be watchable on our website and spread ready through all social channels. Thanks to Jared, we'll even have usable data about who's engaging with our video.
I know a lot of you have seen the inspirational videos on our website, Alana says.
Thank you for checking out the awesome videos we put up last week with Mr. and Mrs. Murphy and Connor's sister, Zoe.
And Connor's best friend, my co-president, Evan Hansen.
I smile. Awkwardly, I assume. There was no way I was going to allow anyone to be in the room with me when I did my video. I shot it myself and ended up doing 17 takes before I had something I was willing to share. Alana wanted each of us to talk about the one big thing we learned from Connor. For Cynthia, it was patience. For Larry, empathy. My answer was hope. It was the only thing I could think of that was, and still is, totally and completely true. Zoe might have been more nervous doing her video than I was doing mine. She said she knew what she wanted to say, but every time I started to record her, she'd clam up and go silent. Eventually, she talked about the importance of being independent and self-sufficient. I wonder if that was the answer she originally intended to give, or if she changed her mind at the last second. I never asked. It didn't seem like she wanted me to.
As you know, Connor's favorite place in the entire world was the incredible Autumn Smile apple orchard, I say.
Tragically, Alana says, the orchard closed 7 years ago. This is what the property looks like now.
Onto the screen pops a photo of an empty, overgrown field with tree stumps. A for sale sign hangs on a rotting fence. I've never actually laid eyes on the orchard. I know where it is, but I've never been there. Not with Connor, obviously, or anyone. I never imagined it being so dilapidated and depressing. In my mind, it's green and alive, rows of trees dotted with red apples. The photo vanishes and our faces reappear. I perk up my sagging smile and make a contribution. Connor loved trees.
Connor was obsessed with trees, Alana says. He and Evan used to spend hours together sitting at the orchard, looking at the trees, being with the trees, sharing fun facts they knew about the trees.
That's true. For example, did you know that if you hang a birdhouse on a branch, it won't move up as the tree grows?
I did not know that, Alana says. That is so interesting.
According to the script Alana sent me, it is now time for me to tee up our big announcement. It's been a learning process these last few weeks, figuring out what exactly the Connor Project is and what it should be doing. At the outset, we had only a few pamphlets, parental approval, and a kickoff assembly, which went way better than any of us expected. We weren't prepared for the reaction to my speech, either in a practical sense, her website crashed twice, Jared seemed stumped, or emotionally. Jared and I were blown away to a degree that no one else could fully appreciate, and it caused us to stop and acknowledge what, until then, had gone unspoken. We both agreed. No one could ever know the truth. This thing we started was actually helping people. The truth now would only cause harm. A whole week went by after my speech before we realized that we weren't capitalizing on all the attention. New followers were still jumping on board, but some of our original followers had already lost interest and left. People kept arriving at our online door inspired by this newfound belief that they were not alone, that they didn't have to live with that burden anymore, that they could lessen it by sharing it with so many others who felt the exact same way. And we'd invite them into this new home of ours, except we soon realized that we had nothing tangible to offer them once they were inside. We weren't keeping them engaged. So we made adjustments. Jared installed an email sign-up form on our homepage so we could send out regular newsletters. Alana had us do the What Connor Taught Me videos, and now we're about to launch our most ambitious endeavor yet. There was one thing that Connor wished more than anything, I say. He hoped that someday the apple orchard would be brought back to life.
Which is where you come in.
Alana posts a digital rendering of a beautiful new orchard. Bountiful trees and tranquil benches nestled inside an idyllic park. There's even a bird soaring across the sun. Jared introduced Alana to a free 3D modeling program, and Alana managed to teach herself how to use it over a single weekend. Today we are announcing the start of a major online fundraising campaign, I say.
One of the most ambitious crowdfunding initiatives since the internet was first created.
We are looking to raise $50,000 in 3 weeks.
It's a lot of money, I know, but it's also a lot of amazing.
The money will go to restoring the orchard, I say. It will be a space for everyone to enjoy. When I told Cynthia we had decided to use all the attention the Connor Project was getting to raise money to restore the orchard, she hugged me tighter than I've ever been hugged before. And when I told her what I wanted to call it, I thought she might never let go.
It's up to all you wonderful people out there to make the Connor Murphy Memorial Orchard not just a dream,
Alana says. She waits, clears her throat, and repeats.
Not just a dream?
Oops, that's my cue.
But a reality,
I say. We thank our viewers and end the video. Alana's face fills my entire screen. That went well, I tell her, relieved it's over and mildly impressed with myself.
Yeah, next time we need to rehearse before we go live,
Alana says. Sometimes I feel more like a vice president than a co-president, but it's fine. It's all for a good cause.
Okay, Alana says. Now let's discuss local outreach.
I move the cursor over to reveal the time. It's already late in the morning.
You mean like right now?
There's no time like the present.
Actually, I can't right now. I'm sorry, I have plans.
I used to marvel at the endurance of Alana's smile. I understand now that she has several other looks. In fact, she doesn't smile nearly as often as I once thought. The look she's giving me right this second, for example, is downright chilling.
Very well, she says. I'm going to print up postcards to promote the orchard campaign.
That's a great idea, I say.
What would really be great is if you could help me hand them out around town.
Of course, definitely. Just let me know when you want to do it.
Okay, great. Well, I have a lot of work to do, so you go have fun and I'll talk to you later.
She signs off, clearly annoyed with me. But I decide to take her advice. I will have fun. Now that I finally understand what the word means. I look behind me. No peeking.
I'm not, Zoe says.
Her eyes seem closed, but a blindfold would have been a safer bet. We're almost there, I say. Watch your step up here, the trail gets bumpy. She holds onto the strap of my backpack while I guide us through Ellison Park. A few more feet and I found the perfect spot. Zoe obediently keeps her eyes shut while I unload supplies from my backpack.
I'm nervous, she says.
So am I. I direct her where to sit, with words only. I still get nervous after all this time to actually make contact with her.
Is this a blanket, I feel? Zoe says.
You can open your eyes. She looks down, and all around, and at me.
A picnic!
I open the white paper bag that I've been carrying this whole time, the last thing I picked up before getting Zoe. You said you never tried the Korean taco truck, so... I hand her a taco wrapped in aluminum foil. Our fingers brush lightly and we smile at each other. And for my last surprise, I raise my arm into the air, but she doesn't get it. I wiggle my arm and give her a hint. It's not jazz hands. She keeps looking until it finally sinks in.
Your cast is off! I totally forgot that was happening.
I lower my arm and pull my sleeve down. I don't want her to inspect it too closely. It's not a pretty sight. Ghostly pale with thick dark hair. I wanted the cast off for so long, but now that it's gone, I kind of miss it. I feel unbalanced and naked, like a part of me is missing.
I have a weird question, Zoe says. Every time she asks me something, I brace for the end of everything.
Okay.
What did you do with the cast?
Not such a weird question, actually. After the doctor sawed it off, he asked me what I wanted to do with it. My gut said trash it. It had spelled nothing but trouble for me from the start. Keeping it would only be a reminder of all the pain. I kept it, I say. I don't know why. It's the truth. I did keep it, and I really don't know why. My answer seems to satisfy her. Same for the taco. There's kimchi dropping everywhere. She searches for a napkin in the white paper bag.
So this is where you worked all summer?
Yeah. It feels weird to be back.
I feel dumb asking, but what exactly does an apprentice park ranger do?
You're not dumb at all. Believe me, I didn't know what it was either. I just assumed I'd be walking around a lot, you know, being surrounded by nature. But there's a lot more to it. You have to know everything about the park, its ecosystem, geography, natural resources, history, because if a visitor asks you a question, you need to have an answer. Then there's the maintenance duties, cleaning the restrooms, restocking maps, changing light bulbs. Also, you have to know basic first aid, just in case of an emergency. And then, on top of all that, you're sort of the police officer of the whole park, which means learning all these laws and making sure people follow them.
Sounds like you really enjoyed it.
I did. Yeah. Being at the park was such a welcome reprieve from my normal existence. Having some place to go, something to do. Half the time I'd forget that I was here to work. I'd just stop and look around and feel, I don't know, calm, I guess.
So when you and Connor were talking about trees in your emails, you were really talking about trees? Zoe says.
Of course. What did you think we were talking about?
Nothing.
Before I can inquire further, she asks me something else.
Have you always been so into nature?
I think so, I say, washing down my taco with water. I probably get it from my dad. That's why he moved to Colorado. He thought the East Coast was too crowded. My mom is convinced that my dad's whole thing about green space was an excuse, that he was really just following Teresa out there, but that's how I remember it.
Then again, it was a long time ago, so maybe I have it all wrong. Before my parents got divorced, my dad took me fishing a few times, and once we all did a whole camping weekend here in the park. As I chew my taco, the memory takes hold. I remember my dad hanging a hammock between two trees so he could sleep under the stars. I asked him how he knew the trees would hold him up. "Trust me," he said. "A hurricane could tear through here and these trees would still be standing." I believed him, but I couldn't stop worrying. I kept picturing the trees toppling over and my dad getting hurt. But he was right. When my mom and I came out of the tent the next morning, he was still hanging there. He said it was the best night's sleep of his life. Before we cleared out, he helped me carve my initials into one of the trees so we could come back to it next time. But there was no next time. The first thing I did when I started my apprenticeship at the park was try to find that tree. Every time I walked a new trail, I looked for it, but I couldn't find it. Eventually, I gave up. The park is way too big, and it was such a long time ago. "What did he say about your speech?" Zoe says. "Serves me right for bringing up my dad. He doesn't know about my speech, of course. The last time I tried to share news like that with him, it didn't go well." Zoe gleans enough from my silence. "Have you not shown it to him?"
"How's that taco? Delicious, right?"
"Evan." I love it when she says my name. She sits patiently, waiting for me to trust her. I feel like I can. "I plan to show him," I say, proceeding with caution. "I guess I'm just waiting for the right time. He's been really busy lately, with work and Teresa being pregnant. Also, they've been looking for a new house, and I know they're really hoping to move in before the baby's born."
"Wait, you never said anything about a baby. Boy or girl?"
"Boy." Zoe lights up.
"No way. That's awesome. You're gonna have a baby brother."
"I guess," is all I say. Because while I trust her, and I do, I don't trust myself to talk about this. As Zoe turns quiet, I realize something. She lost a brother, and here I am about to gain one. Maybe I don't have a right to be bitter about it. "It hasn't really sunk in yet, the whole brother thing," I say. What I don't say: I wish my dad kept track of my life without me having to always be the one to tell him about it.
"Well," Zoe says, "you're gonna be the best big brother. And I'm sure your dad isn't too busy to be so proud of what you've done."
As much as I've told her, she doesn't know the half of it. "All this used to be private property," I say, gesturing around us. "Back in the 20s, there was this guy who lived out here with his family. People assume his name was Ellison, but it was actually Hewitt. Ellison is a made-up name." I turn around to check if Zoe's still with me. We've been walking the trail for a long time, and I've been talking even longer. Now that Zoe switched me on, I can't switch myself off. "Sorry, I don't know why I'm telling you all this."
"No, I like it. Keep going."
"Okay, well, what happened was there was a big fire at John Hewitt's house, and it wiped out everything, including his wife and kids. He couldn't bear to live here anymore, so he made some sort of deal with the state to have the land turned into a park in his family's memory. He asked that it be called Ellison. It's a combination of his wife's name, Ellen, and his kids, Lila and Nelson."
"No way," Zoe says.
"I just got the chills."
"I know, right? My boss told me that."
The most remarkable part of that story to me is that the guy could have gone with the family name, Hewitt, and that would have included all of them. But I guess he wanted to take himself out of it and make it about them only. It's unfortunate that more people don't know who made this place possible and how.
"Do you know where the house was?" Zoe asks. "Where the family lived before they..."
I shake my head, sorry to disappoint her. I should ask Ranger Gus if he knows. Zoe stops in her tracks and takes a wide scan of the surroundings.
"To be honest, I always forget this place exists, even though it's right under my nose.
And a perfect nose it is. Her beauty easily trumps the park's."
"So," I say, "while I was here all summer, where were you?"
"I worked at a camp over in Riverside during the day, and a few nights at that new yogurt shop on the boulevard." I nod, pretending that I never once walked past that yogurt shop this summer after hearing she was working there.
"Sounds like you were busy."
"Guess so," Zoe says. I try to be home as little as possible.
It's the opposite for me. Or it was.
Zoe walks ahead. I advised her to wear sneakers today, but I wasn't picturing Converse. They're not exactly made